Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
You're listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. When Banksy's painting, Girl with Balloon, self-shredded upon being sold at Sotheby's for a staggering $1.4 million, the world was shocked not only by the price tag or even that an artist would choose to use an auction system so flagrantly, but rather that this act might actually end up increasing the value of the piece. The art market is a strange and giant beast that's impenetrable as it is mercurial. A new documentary that's currently playing at the Quad Cinema and that will also make its debut on HBO on Monday, November 12, takes on the challenging questions about the relationship between art and money and how the art market has dramatically expanded in the last 50 years. Titled The Price of Everything, the film's name is derived from an Oscar Wilde quote about cynics saying that they know the price of everything and the value of nothing. The film is directed by Academy Award-nominated documentary filmmaker Nathaniel Kahn. Thanks for being with us, Nathaniel.
Thank you for
having
me.
And he's joining us in studio is Pulitzer Prize-winning art critic Jerry Saltz, who is also in the film. Hi, Jerry.
Hi.
So, Nathaniel, present this staggering figure in the film, that the art market moves about $56 billion annually. What was the turning point or the moment when this tsunami of money just started to flood the art world?
Well, we sort of identify it in the film as being this auction that took place in 1973 called the Skull Auction, which was really the first time that that art by living artists was put to auction, and suddenly people realized that they could buy low and sell high, and so, you know, it's been going on from there. But this relationship between art and money has been around for a very long time, but never like this. And for me, coming from a family of artists, it's actually quite terrifying when you realize that people are now buying art not just for the love of it, and maybe not even just to think about, well, maybe the price will go up someday, but actually as a speculative financial instrument. That's new.
Jerry, what does it mean, or what were some of the unintended consequences of art becoming only available to the 0.0001%?
Right. Well, the market that you see in The Price of Everything, an incredibly well-made film, is still, nevertheless, only 1% of 1% of 1% of everybody in the art world. This is about 55 people, maybe 55 collectors and 55 artists, mostly white, mostly male, probably painters, but not always. And I agree with Nathaniel. It's not new. It is new in the degree. Mm-hmm. And the downside in what the film did to me is it just makes it almost impossible for anyone in the public to look at art without seeing it through the filter of money. And this begats one of the most dangerous things of all to art, which is cynicism. That you become jaded before you've even given the art a shot. You hate Jeff Koons before you know all of his work. And I think that's a shame, but that's what's going on. And the film does portray that. It made every person I know in the art world sad.
It made me sad as someone who loves to go to museums, the idea that there's a whole bunch of stuff I'll never see. Because it's in somebody's collection, or it might be in somebody's basement.
Well, I said that in your film. I said auctions are a last goodbye to so much great art, and yet the audiences applaud it all, and it's a nightmare.
Well,
and it'll end. It will end.
Exactly. And I think in the end, art is way more powerful than that. And I think that, as always, art is also revealing to us who we are right now. Art holds a dark mirror up to us, and this idea that money is controlling everything and that ultimately everything can be commoditized, including experience, this is something that I think actually art is telling us something very, very important. The question is, will we listen? And the hope with the film is it shines a light into this area, which I think people sort of may not know so much about. But it may be depressing. But there's also so much hope in it. When you see the artists in this film working, when you see them having to turn away from this idea in their own head that their art may or may not be selling well, artists have to put that out of their head, which Jerry says beautifully in the film. An artist must not be thinking about the price of their work. Otherwise, the work will suffer. Art is so much smarter than anybody who's ever made it. Art knows, and art shows us exactly what's true and what's not.
I would say just one thing. You said money controls everything. I would say money controls only these things. That most of the people I know aren't that involved in it, although we are more than aware of it. And, you know, we gawk at it too. But there's enormous, as you allude to, other things going on in the art world. Right now, women, artists of color, that's an extraordinary story to be told. That's the real price of everything, that suddenly the gates are down. They're coming into institutions, galleries, and indeed the market, as the film touches on. That is a great story. This film doesn't tell that story. This film tells, I think, the end of empire, frankly.
Yes, you've said that, and I think, you know, point well taken. But I would say, here's how I think it does tell that story, is it is showing the artists who are putting that out of their mind. So the film really exists and works on contrasts. It's showing this high-end market and how it works. It's the playbook for that market. I feel that's very, we have to look at things, we have to understand things if we're ever going to change them. So it shows that playbook, but in contrast to that, it's the artists working.
I feel a real sense of passion from you, but and I'm assuming it's from your family. You're from a family of artists. Your father's a famous architect. And when I hear you talk about this and I hear you interview in the film, I feel like you are speaking for some artists in some ways.
I hope so.
Yeah?
I hope so. I mean, yes, I grew up in a family of artists, and I saw firsthand, and Jerry and I talked about this. You know, my father was never in any way a cynic, nor am I. But my father absolutely suffered greatly for you know, financially. But he just kept going, which is what you have to do. But it was actually easier then. He died in 1974. It's a lot harder now because there's a lot more money around and a lot more people, fewer people have it, and a lot more people don't have it. So I think it's harder to get by now without financial help than it was then. So yes, I come from a family of artists. I
Lewis
saw it
Kahn
firsthand.
Is your father, yes.
It's true. And I, you know, I saw that struggle firsthand.
Yeah.
And I sort of see with a sense of shock, you know, what is happening now in the art world. And I was very lucky to have in this film the producers involved in this film, who had access to that world so I could get in there. And it's very important.
The access was amazing.
It's insane.
Well, that's right.
Right?
Yeah.
I've never seen.
I kept away. I was like.
Well, actually, you were one of the hardest people to get to, Jerry.
Well, that's because I work times. Alone and nobody, I don't know how to answer.
But luckily, Jennifer Stockman was able to finally get to. I wanted to interview you so much because your passion and your anger at what you've seen happening, you're not afraid to go there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I had to have that voice in the film.
Well, I was happy to be in it, even though when I saw the film and I said this and I wrote this, it did make me sick to my stomach thinking, well, people are seeing, as I said, a very accurate picture of a tiny, highly visible portion of the art world. And you do rightly add that when we see the artists, things calm down, they feel good, you're in a state of grace. But I, as I wrote in my review, all of the artists chosen were either now or former major art stars, some in the making, some of the vaunted 1960s. And I would have been interested to see, like I said, the 99.1 example from the 99.999% of the artists, dealers, gallerists, collectors, everyone else that is, we're getting on with this.
I'm not going to name names,
but doing great.
That is actually there. I want you to watch it again.
Okay.
I've seen it three
I'm not
going to
name names.
I love watching
but
you
too. But anyway, there are and the but
there
the
might
other,
be okay.
No, okay. But one of the most gratifying things for me was to show this in communities around the world. Now, I took it to Detroit. Mm-hmm. And some wonderful artists came to the screening, and we talked afterwards. And these are artists who are starting their own galleries. They're out there. They are creating art. They have their alternative economy, you know.
Interesting.
And they said, thank you for making something that actually showed us how this works. Because now that we understand it, we can do it differently. And that, I mean, to me, that was the most gratifying thing at all.
That's so interesting. It was wonderful.
Yeah. Now, I'm not saying there isn't this also the depression, you know, the horrifying aspect mm-hmm. of it. But we have to be able to look at these things to understand. Once again, art is showing us who we are right now. It's holding a dark mirror up to us. Those shiny surfaces of those incredible Jeff Koons pieces.
Those are some of the greatest shots in the documentary.
But they're reflecting they really us, and I think that's very willful on his part. He wants us to see that.
How did you get Jeff Koons and George Conner to let you
How
go
did
in
you
there
do
and
that?
Film them working?
Well, as I say, I think I was very lucky to have Jennifer Stockman, who's one of the producers. She had been in the art market and in the art world mm-hmm. for 20 years or more, but working as one of the, she was the chairman of the board of Guggenheim. So she knew a lot of these people and was able to say, look, you know, let us in there.
This is going to be okay.
And you know where he interviewed me? I don't know how he did this, in the director of the Whitney Museum's office.
That was not the director's office. That was a side office, Jerry.
A side office.
Like
making
I
up
know.
Stories.
I
no, listen, know. The interesting thing was I loved that spot where we interviewed you because somehow you were sort of trapped in this corner.
Totally.
Right?
We're speaking with Nathaniel Kahn, the director of The Price of Everything, a new documentary that is in theaters now, select theaters, and will be on HBO 11/12. 11/12, yes, 11/12. And Pulitzer Prize winning writer and art critic Jerry Saltz. So something that's interesting, I want to get to this because one of the main people that you spend a lot of time with is Larry Poons.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Larry was a later discovery.
I mean, it's just a wonderful part of the film of this artist watching his colleagues and contemporaries have these amazing careers. And we meet him, looks like it's upstate New York. Is it upstate?
Yes, it is.
A barn, a clapboard barn, making these gorgeous canvases.
Yes. Well, the discovery of Larry was,
oh my gosh.
We began to put this together and we had, you know, these incredible interviews with people. And I suddenly thought as I was sitting there with the editor, Sabina Crombie, we were looking at the footage. And my fear suddenly was, oh my God, does this film have a soul? Every film has to have a soul. Where's the soul? It's good. It's interesting. It's fascinating. But where's the sort of deep low note in this whole thing? So I talked to an art dealer friend, and I described the person I wanted to see. Someone who had been very much on the mm-hmm. top of the art market. Somebody who had suffered. Somebody who had fallen out. Maybe somebody who lived mm-hmm. upstate. Oh, it'd be great if they were in a house that was kind of, you know, was maybe a little bit in need of some extra paint, and you know, and that they were living off the grid. And she said, stop. I know exactly who you need to see. You need to see Larry Poons. So it took some time to get to Larry. And luckily, through his wife, Paula, we were able to get this incredible encounter. And the moment he walked out and started talking, and Bob Richman, the cinematographer, and Eddie O'Connor, the sound guy, we go in rolling. We don't, like, stop and say, okay, here's what we want to talk about.
We'll do a setup, and here's this now, right?
Larry started going. We started filming. And the encounter that's in the film is 5 minutes after we met. But the great fear for me, because I'd seen his early dot paintings, is what's the work like now? And I actually put off going into the studio for quite some time. And that moment that's in the film is one of my favorite. It's one of those just marvelous aha moments that happens in verite filmmaking, that something unfolds in front of the camera that you couldn't predict. Yeah. And he's reluctant to lead us into the studio. And he says, follow Paula. It's always a good idea. And we follow her into this studio, and it opens up like this cave at Lascaux. It's as if we've walked into a temple of art. And the way Larry paints, 60-foot canvas strung around the whole room. He paints the entire thing all at once and excavates the painting later. So it was just this sea of color that was in front of
it's
you.
It's so beautiful.
And it's, you know, this is a man who's in his 80s, his early 80s. Still races a motorcycle, by the way. But to see that passion, that vibrancy, that love, after having been at the top of the art world and then fallen off for a long time, he just kept doing the work. And that's what matters. Mm-hmm. That's what artists give us.
Yeah.
They do the work.
I want to ask about the collectors a little bit and bring you in, Jerry, because it's so interesting to focus on, the Edlis family? And to give people a sense of the kind of money these people have, I looked them up on the Forbes, people who give the most. Number one is Buffett. Number two is Gates. Number three is Soros. Number four is Stefan Edlis and his wife, Gail.
Wow. Yeah.
Bloomberg's behind them to give people a sense.
Well, as he says, for that one year.
Okay. For that one year.
Right.
So, I'm interested in you as the art critic.
Right.
When you watch collectors like this, are they doing it because they love art, or are they doing it because they want to have some sort of posthumous legacy in the art world?
I think it's a combination of both. It's a great question. I think one of the things that the film points out is all these collectors have the same collection. Each one owns what the other one owns. Nathaniel has one scene where a woman actually says, "All my friends have the same sculpture in different colors." So while I think it comes from love, I don't think it comes from maybe passion. I think it comes from wanting to be right, acceptance. Whatever gets you through the night is okay with me. And Atlas, being extraordinarily generous, he gave 40 pieces to my home, where I'm from, museum, Chicago, the Art Institute of Chicago, including the good stuff, not just the crap.
No, the really good
but
stuff.
But the way they all talk about art can really, it made the hair on the back of my neck stand up when they said, "Brown is no good, don't paint fish." It was absolute nonsense. And then much later at a dinner party, I ended up in a screaming match with some of these collectors who I don't really know, who before the election were ranting about voting for Trump. And then I, like an idiot, said, "Then you really don't understand the art that's all around you." The same way I've said that to Trump people who voted for Springsteen. "You don't get what he's saying." And they looked at me like I was a dumb cluck. And one art dealer started jumping on the table, yelling at them, and I walked home at night and realized we live in contradiction now and paradox in our art world, in the whole world. And this will pass. And art will be, as Nathaniel says, in great shape.
You have to watch the film. It's called The Price of Everything. It premieres on HBO on Monday, November 12th. It's down at the Quad now. Nathaniel Kahn and Jerry Saltz, thank you so much for coming into All of It.
Thank you. Coming up
next on All of It, a rebroadcast of my conversation with Bill Irwin about his new show about Samuel Beckett. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Our next guest is Tony Award-winning actor Bill Irwin. He created and stars in a show playing at the Irish Repertory Theater in Chelsea, and it's all about his relationship with Samuel Beckett and his works. It's called, appropriately enough, On Beckett. Over the course of his career, Samuel Beckett wore many hats. An accomplished novelist, writer, and poet, Beckett was awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1969, on his way to become one of the most influential writers of the 20th century. He became a hero to many, including Bill Irwin. You still have time to catch Bill in On Beckett. The show officially closes on November 4th. That's this weekend. Let's take a listen to my conversation with Bill Irwin. Take me back to when you were first exposed to Beckett. Do you remember where you were, what your first impressions were?
I'm sure I'd heard his name, but I was a drama student, didn't hone in on my academics very well. The first thing I knew of his that I was reading, just flipping through pages of an anthology, an English anthology, in what had to have been 1968, and there was this short play by a writer named Samuel Beckett. It was a play called Act Without Words. And interestingly enough, I've never done the play. I don't even, between you and me and all the listeners, mm-hmm. I don't even care for that play among his writings that much. But the way he described in his stage directions, the way he described physical action, and the way he had offstage forces impinging on his single character stayed with me. And that's been part of my theatrical thinking ever since.
And your theatrical life, you act without words.
I do act without words.
Many times.
I have offstage forces in clown material I've done since then, actually. Things pulling at a person who wants to be on stage was pulled off, or the opposite, wants to get off, and he's thrown back on. That idea was seeded with reading this first bit of Beckett text.
Now, you met Beckett briefly, right?
Very briefly, in 1988, toward the end of his life. I was about to play Lucky in a historic production of, and here we're at a crucial point, Allison.
Okay, I was waiting for it.
Is it waiting for Godot or waiting for Godot? And that's a huge divide in Beckett-ophiles and in theater goers generally. Americans tend to say waiting for Godot. Brits and Irish tend to say waiting for Godot. And they both sound ridiculous to each other.
Well, they say Gotterod and aluminium as well.
They do, and vitamins. And it's all part of, you know, the world is more regional and a larger, more fractured place than we often think in this digital age. The conventional wisdom, oh, we're getting so much smaller and tighter, which in ways we are. But the difference between Waiting for Godot and Waiting for Godot is huge. And I was about to play Lucky in a production of, at that time we called it Waiting for Godot. I've changed my tune since. But Mike Nichols was about to direct Robin Williams, Steve Martin, Murray Abraham, and myself, and a young man named Lucas Haas. And I got an introduction to go see Mr. Beckett in Paris. Wonderful man of the theater, who's no longer with us, Mel Gusso, wrote an old-fashioned hard copy letter of introduction.
Oh, I love that. That's such a great time, right?
Very much of the time. And at the time, the procedure was you got to Paris, you went to the appointed place. You didn't call the Beckett household. Although he called the hotel, interestingly, where I was staying. And the woman said, he speaks a very wonderful French. So she was extremely impressed. So I did meet him briefly, and I was so shy, and he was a shy gentleman, that my main memory is of his hands on the table. I had trouble looking up into his face, but his hands were gnarled in a way that I will never forget. And especially in later years, I've come to learn, I didn't know at the time, he was not part of his, you know, popular image. He was quite a pianist.
Hmm.
And when I think to those gnarled hands and how that was something he once did, but it was denied him then by the crippling arthritis, it's just part of my take on Beckett's writing and on his presence in our cultural life.
It's so interesting. I knew you were going to say his hands were gnarled.
Why did
I
you?
I knew. I don't. But that, to me, is part of the image in my mind of him as an older man.
Oh, that is so interesting. He was very tall.
Oh, you know that.
And still had that kind of athletic bearing. I studied, although I didn't go to her class as often as I wish I had, with Ruby Cohn when I was a feckless theater student many years ago. And Ruby was a friend of Mr. Beckett's and a scholar of his. And she always said, you know, she was a gay woman, so I don't think it was direct attraction necessarily, but it was human attraction. She said, oh, he's a very tall, athletic, striking man. And that was part of his, that, you know, we show in On Beckett at the Irish Repertory Theater, we show briefly a slide of Mr. Mm-hmm. Beckett's face, just as a reference early in the evening. And you can just feel the audience go, the attention rivets over there, because he was a commanding, but also shy, sort of deprecating, complicated soul, apparently.
You mentioned that at the top of your show that you're not a Beckett scholar.
No.
And you like it that way.
I do like it that way.
Did you consult with any scholars for the production, however?
Well, I've done a lot of reading, yes. And Carrie Perloff, wonderful, mad, wacky Carrie Perloff, who ran for 30 years the ACT Theater in San Francisco, her mother is Marjorie Perloff, a sort of well-known Beckett scholar. So when we worked on this idea for an evening, maybe called On Beckett, maybe called something else, it had been in my head for a long time. This notion of finding a way to share with an audience the place that this language has come to occupy in my brain, and maybe as a coping mechanism for what to do with all this Beckett language. And because, as I also say in the evening, I'm not sure what draft you may have because we change it nightly, mm-hmm. but what is it about this language? It stays with me when so many other big, beautiful pieces of language that I've memorized over the decade isn't accurate. They fade away. I mean, really great stuff that I wish I could recall. Shakespeare, other stuff that I've put in my head. It goes away, but Beckett's voice stays.
What does not being a Beckett scholar allow you to do? That if you knew too much, what do you think?
Well, it's really easy to get pulled into, now, when did you write this? And when, here's a wackola fact. I say in the evening, I can never wrap my head around this. I have to just present it. At about the age of 40, you'd have to consult a real scholar, but as the war was ending, he turned from writing in English to writing in French. Just a decision he made as a writer. He said some cryptic things about it, but he never really explained. Many people have written great things about it. One critic said it was almost like he needed to write in costume for a while. So he turned to French, and it seems that maybe he was just going to leave it that way and pursue French writing for a French reader, but eventually he did begin to translate his own work into his own Irish-English idiom, and thank God, because je ne parle pas, and I wouldn't have any Samuel Beckett in my life, which actually might have a measure of comfort to it, but I wouldn't know Samuel Beckett's voice if he hadn't translated what I think of as back into his Irish-English. And it sounds like great uncles of mine, whom I dimly remember, it sounds like a lot of voices. It also sounds like the inside of my own head, because I think that's the way his writing operates, like the inner argument of consciousness. And that's one of the reasons I cannot get this writer and don't want to get this writer out of my life. It's also, Allison, it's a means of examination. You know, I have a couple generations on you, but my generation, we were taught to revere Socrates and examine our lives, you know, lest they be found not worth living. And Beckett's language, Beckett's writing, is a means of examination. I mean, in this current time right now, we're having this chat right now, but I think we'll be put on the air some other time because of the historic testimony down in Washington and events hourly in our national life. It's a good time to have some different means of examination. Look at the questions of how the human psyche works and why do I think this? Why is that behavior taking place? And why am I having this response to it? And Beckett's writing, for me, helps me with that. It's like I say, a means of examination. Mr. Socrates, at least millennia later, that is a means I use to try to parse things out in the human psyche.
Well, I'm flattered you think we're generations apart, but we're not. So thank you.
I'm flattered you think we're not.
We're speaking with Bill Irwin about his new show on Beckett. I'm going to put you on the spot. You've said that Beckett lives in your head, certain passages. Would you share one with us?
I have so many. It's merely a matter of choosing. There are a series of works called Texts for Nothing, these odd little pieces of text, of prose, that he wrote in 1950, which coincidentally, pursuant to our conversation of just a moment ago, is the year of my birth. And so I feel a connection there. He was writing these as I was being born. It's beautiful, haunting, weird, mysterious language. Text number one is a text that I use in the evening, and it sort of threads its way around in this Irish voice. But suddenly it gets to this line. And if I'm having trouble in the evening, or if I'm thinking, tonight is not as good as last night, I'm trying to center myself in this language, this line, and I hope mentioning doesn't jinx this, but this line always kind of pulls me in. And the line is this: yes, I was my father, and I was my son. I asked myself questions and answers as best I could. I had it told me evening after evening, the same old story I knew by heart and couldn't believe. Or we walked together, hand in hand, silent, sunk in our worlds, each in his worlds, the hands forgotten in each other. That's how I've held out till now. And this evening, again, it seems to be working. I'm in my arms. I'm holding myself in my arms, without much tenderness, but faithfully. Faithfully. That's just one little stretch of language, you know, you can just pull them off almost any page. And here's the interesting thing, Allison. They sound and feel, especially to an actor, like they were written to be done as monologues. They were just his prose. He wrote things for the stage, as we well know, waiting for Godot, Godot, and many other plays. But a lot of the writings that haunt me and that I share with the audience in this evening are prose pieces. They're not written for the stage, but they feel like maybe they were at some level.
At one point, you described the show as an experiment. What did you want to experiment with?
Well, like I said a moment ago, it's a way of sharing with audiences what is driving me, and maybe a coping mechanism for figuring out, with company in the room, and I hope usefully for those who buy a ticket and come to the Irish Rep, what place this language occupies. And again, why it haunts me, and other things I seem capable of putting aside, at least from the conscious mind. But certain stretches of language stay with me. You know, Beckett has a recurring theme of beginning. To begin. That's my life. without having ended, helpless to begin. That's from text number 9. And it's a touchstone. The final lines of that text echo the final lines of Dante's Inferno, for instance. And that line from Dante is on the cover page of William Styron's book, Darkness Visible, a memoir of madness about his life, sometimes in the grip of severe depression, and sometimes he could break free of it. And that line, Darkness Visible, is from Milton, Paradise Lost. It just seems that there are some common touchstones for people, men and women, who've descended to a hell and then fought their way back up again. And that's a recurrent theme in Beckett's writing. And as I say in the evening, what does this mean about Samuel Beckett and his mental health? It's not for me to say. It's kind of beside the point. But I feel the thread and the energy in the writing, and it feels useful to me.
In the San Francisco production of this, I believe you took Q&A, is that correct?
We did. In the San Francisco experiments, if I can go back to that word, I wasn't sure it was a long enough evening. You know, I knew I had these texts. I had a few things to say. I didn't know how long it would last. So the San Francisco producers said, well, we better put Q&A on there then, just to make sure people don't go home too early. So yeah, we did Q&A every night there.
What kind of insights did you get from the audience about Beckett, about the performance?
Oh, it was wonderful. It was also, you know, the human equation is so rich. It was wonderful one moment. It was tedious the next, like all like all Q&A and like all of life. People were startled often. Oh, I thought he was just kind of detached and philosopher playwright who he liked to survey the bleakness. But I thought that was it. When you really get into his writing, some of the bleakness that he did contemplate had to do with really huge immediate questions. There's a line from the novel Watt, and Watt is the only thing in the evening, the passage from Watt is the only thing in the evening I share with the audience that was written in English. Everything else, French to his Irish English. But Watt he wrote before turning to French, and there are some lines: the whacks, the moans, the cracks, the groans, the welts, the squeaks, the belts, the shrieks, the pricks, the prayers, the kicks, the tears, the scalps, and the yelps, and the poor old lousy old earth. By the way, I'm leaning into that with a little bit of an American voice because I perceive that as part of my mission, is to bring an American voice to this. There are lots of great Irish interpreters and British interpreters and all over the world. My contribution, if I have any, is to bring an American voice. That passage, it looks on the page first like it's just kind of Edward Lear, rhyming words to rhyme them. But when you really start memorizing the work of memorization, you see it is eerily exact, the ascending level of violence, and it poses all the questions of this moment, like what is childhood, what is abuse, what is the place of violence in the human equation. And like I say, some people think the popular conception of Samuel Beckett is austere, detached. It's in his writing almost like an open wound, that sensitivity to violence and that question of why do we do this to each other?
It's the human question.
Yeah.
It really is from the beginning of time.
Yeah, exactly. And it's much more immediate than we often think. The play Waiting for Godot has a reputation of being something. In fact, when you go back now, there's a 33 recording of the original American production of Waiting for Godot. And it's great to listen to. Burt Lahr and E.G. Marshall, Kurt Kasner, a wonderful cast of people. But whether it's the way they did it on stage or whether it was just the record producer, he didn't quite trust the audience not to get it. So every time they said, the characters often say, let's go, we can't, why not, we're waiting for Godot. We're waiting for Godot, whoa, 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 whoa. They made it an echo effect.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah, because they were afraid, the audience wouldn't get that this was heavy.
It's monumental.
It's monumental. That's one thing I say in the evening, the word existentialism puts people asleep. That's why I'll only say it this one time. But questions of being and survival, they keep us awake. And that's what I feel in this language. Like when I watch the moment-to-moment, hour-to-hour coverage of what's going on in our national government life right now, it's the moment consciousness.
We're all listening to Bill Irwin about his new show on Beckett at the Irish Repertory Theater. You are not alone in this performance.
I am not. It is
young
not.
Young man. There's a young man.
There is a young man. It takes the curse off a one-man show, both for me, for the audience, and I hope for young Mr. Finn O'Sullivan.
Could the name be better?
His middle name is Michael, by the way. And could that be better? And could doing this evening on the, and being commissioned for this newest version of On Beckett by the Irish Repertory Theater, that could not be better. It's a dream come true. Besides, it's two blocks from my house, so it's wonderful. But each evening, and though we talk about it and it's in the program, I hope there's a surprise element. Each evening, at a certain point, when I'm talking about the play Waiting for Godot or Waiting for Godot, depending on how you come down, Finn's voice enters from out in the audience.
And we say Finn is a young man.
He's a young man. He's an 11-year-old actor from St. David's School. Lord bless him and his parents that they let him throw himself into this thing. And he's there every night doing his homework in the dressing room. And he does make an appearance. And for me, I don't want to tell the audience how to think, but I'll just tell you what I think on stage. I've been talking for maybe 50 minutes by that time and doing Beckett texts, sharing things from the unnameable, from texts for nothing, from these off-the-beaten-track bits of prose. When Finn's young face comes onto the stage, it says what Beckett had in mind to say. It's old daughtery people wondering what they should be doing, who they should be waiting for, and then a boy comes with a message. I get a little what's the Yiddish word I'm looking for?
Verklempt.
Thank you. Every time he steps on, and of course I'm wondering, are he and I going to remember our lines right? So far, so good.
You've invested so much of your professional life, and I get a sense of your personal life in your relationship with Beckett. Has that relationship changed over time as you've done the show in one city and then another city and then not done the show, just lived with it?
Right. Hourly. Changes hourly. And that's the vibrancy of this language and the place I think it plays in our culture. You know, when I was a university student, when I first came upon this piece of writing of Beckett's, one of the reasons I didn't know more about him is because people talked about him as a French modernist at that time in the 60s. Since then, he's become acknowledged to be an Irish voice. And there are Irish interpreters. One actor whom I love, an actor named Connor Lovett, who's with Gare St. Lazare. He and his wife, Judy Lovett, run the company together. Connor probably has 6 hours of Beckett in his head. I have maybe 58 minutes or so. And when you sit with Connor, you just realize he's a repository of all this language. And the language is changing in our culture. It used to be way off the beaten track. Now it's less off the beaten track. In fact, everybody in their email has gotten the joke, the picture of a guy standing at the airport with a sign.
Yes.
Godot, Waiting for Godot. It's part of our household culture, and at the same time, it's way off the beaten track. That's why his writing is so interestingly hard to get a hold of. One thing I say in the evening, you cannot bring it to heel or make summary of it or corral this wild and deep body of work. It's just, every time you think you've got a key, that turns out not to be the key. So to answer your question, yeah, hour to hour.
Given all that's going on in the world right now, why is this work relevant, this Beckett's work?
It's relevant because, we were saying a moment ago, for me at least, it's a way of looking at how the human mind works. You know, the scientists are now talking a lot about, and if I were a true scholar, I could quote you better, but talking about the multiplicity of voices that make up a consciousness. It's an inner argument, and that probably, from what little I've read as a layman, traces back to evolutionary forces. You know, like early mammals, should I go for it? No, stay here behind the rock. No, but I'm hungry, but it's danger. You know, inner argument, that's, there's a great quote from someplace about a guy who studied birds. And he was looking at a certain kind of bird and the way the bird used the beak. And he said, human beings, our mind is our beak. We're like tearing at things. We kick it apart. that's the way the brain seems to have evolved, and that's what I get in Beckett's language. Besides, it's just being beautiful in a sort of poetic but anti-poetic way at the same time.
Before I let you go, I want to ask you about two things. I loved you in the movie Rachel Getting Married.
I'm so glad you saw it, Allison. Thank you. That was a great gift. Jonathan Demme, who was a friend and neighbor, said, I want you to read this script. Jerk that I am, I read it and I said, God, it's a great script. I don't think that's me. I think, you know, that man is Jewish. And I almost talked myself out of one of the greatest roles of my life to get to play Paul, the father of this complicated, troubled family. And I'm glad you saw the film. I thank you for seeing it.
And with your voice, have you ever done audiobooks?
Yes.
Which ones? When can I listen to them?
It was a long time ago because it's the hardest work I've ever done as an actor. It's hard. It's really hard. But I have the great honor of saying I did The Hardy Boys back when my son was 7 years old. And they're a little dicey.
They are of a time.
They're of a time.
They'll say that graciously. That'll be a gracious description.
That's the best gracious thing you can say. But they do have a certain compelling energy, and I had such fun with them because wanted to keep up a pace. Frank, the blonde-haired older boy, Joe, who's his somewhat younger brother, you know, you wanted to keep energy going, but it was the hardest work I've ever done. And I haven't been asked to do many since, I will say, Allison.
All right. Well, maybe that'll change after this interview. Bill Oren's On Beckett will be at the Irish Repertory Theater through November 4th. Bill, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. And I hope to see people at the Irish Repertory Theater.
You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Our next guest has written about Amazonian explorations, convoluted murder conspiracies, and an elderly man who could just not stop robbing banks. His previous book, Killers of the Flower Moon, won a National Book Award finalist, was one. And the movie based on his story, The Old Man and the Gun, is in theaters now, starring Robert Redford. Now journalist and New Yorker staff writer David Grand turns his sights on Antarctica as he covers the life and adventures of explorer Henry Worsley in his new book, The White Darkness. Welcome to All of It.
Oh, thanks for having me on the show.
So Henry Worsley, you've helped me with his name.
Worsley
decided he was going to attempt to be the first person to cross Antarctica on foot unassisted. Please explain to folks why Henry wanted to take this on.
That's a great question. Henry, ever since he was young, had been obsessed with polar exploration, these people who would venture into the most uninhabitable place, temperatures 70 degrees minus Fahrenheit, winds at 100 miles per hour. He also had a special connection to Shackleton, who had earlier made this trek. He had a relative who had been part of an expedition led by Ernest Shackleton. But I think he saw it as a way to test his own character, to test his own endurance and his leadership. He was somebody who strongly believed in Shackleton's family motto, which was, by endurance we conquer.
And he was a military man.
He had served two tours with the SAS, which is an elite commando unit. And it's equally incredibly arduous. People have tried to take the test to pass it, have died taking it.
Wow.
And Henry was among the few who passed it.
And he had hooked up with some other people whose ancestors had a relationship to Shackleton. Is this what gave him the idea?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think all his life he had dreamed and burned to become an explorer. He was a polymath. He was an artist. He was a sculptor. He was a military commander. He had become a leading authority on Shackleton and on polar explorers. But what he really always wanted to do was go on an expedition and to see if he could do it. And so in 2008, he teamed up with two other descendants of Shackleton's original crew, and they set out to walk to the South Pole, to do what Shackleton had tried to do but failed on his expedition. And that is what planted the seed, and that was Henry Worsley's first expedition.
And these expeditions were incredibly dangerous and arduous, and you can't even imagine somebody wanting to do this or even surviving doing this. I want you to read a passage. This is a description of ice in a way that lets you know the kind of conditions they were in.
With nothing to stare at but ice, Worsley was becoming a connoisseur of its varieties. It could be squeaky or powdery or crusty. The wind often sculpted it into waves known as stratugi, which rose as high as 4 feet and sometimes extended in parallel rows to the horizon. Adams, that's one of his companions, noted in a broadcast that each of the men had his own strategy for traversing the frozen waves. Henry tends to herringbone over it, Will declares war on the stratugi, and I tend to try and run at it. Then there was the deep, sludgy ice, the most wretched of all, which made them feel like they were plowing through wet sand. Because it was more taxing to be up front, breaking track, the men took hourly turns in the lead.
I don't want to give too much away about the book. So what was his family thinking when he went on these expeditions and then finally went on the final expedition by himself?
Yeah. So, I mean, what makes Henry so interesting and what really drew me to this story is he's doing something that I could not imagine doing. I am not an explorer. I hate the cold. I prefer to read and research these stories by a warm fire. But Henry was also a devoted family man. And there is this remarkable love story at the center of this story with him and his wife, Joanna. And Joanna was somebody who believed that everybody had what Thomas Pynchon had referred to as their own Antarctica, some place where you seek answers. Except in the case of her husband, it turned out to be Antarctica itself. Mm. And so she would give her blessing to these expeditions, even though she knew it threatened to take the life of the man she loved. And whenever Henry would head off, he would repeat a line from Shackleton that Shackleton had told his wife. And the line was, he would say, "Don't worry, better a live donkey than a dead lion."
What does that mean?
Better come back alive. don't let your bravery lead mm-hmm. you to self-destruction. And there is an inherent tension in that. Mm-hmm. And one of the things to understand Worsley, to get back to your question, is you also have to understand Ernest Shackleton, because Worsley revered him like many people. And Shackleton was in many ways a failure. He had set out to reach the South Pole many times. He had tried to trek across Antarctica, and each time he had failed. But he had always managed to somehow rescue his men from seemingly certain death.
Some of the descriptions of those voyages of the ships becoming encased in ice.
And sinking.
Yeah.
He sank. He was in the Endurance. They literally sank. And the ship sank. They were trapped on an ice floe more than 1,000 miles from the closest contact of civilization. And they didn't have a radio back then. And he had to figure out a way to get them back. And he always did. And so he emerged as kind of one of history's greatest leader. And people have studied him. But one of the central questions Henry Worsley would always ask himself is, what would Shackleton do? What would Shackleton do in a certain situation? And of course, on his last expedition, Henry Worsley was in more peril than he had ever been. And he would ask himself that question, what would Shackleton do? And this time his life would depend on the answer.
What were his views about death?
Well, he obviously took great risk. I don't think he was suicidal in the sense that he was not someone who coveted, to die, but he was somebody willing to test his mettle in the most extreme circumstances. And both in the military and then in Antarctica, he put his life at great risk. Now, he took precautions to try to, master. What he wanted to do was master them, to conquer them, to see if he could. He wasn't a religious man. But he was a spiritual person, and I think he felt a certain spirituality in Antarctica. He once carved in the ice, and I have a photograph of it in the book, and it to me is just the most arresting, and it captures Henry's spirit, which was he carved on one of his expeditions on this massive ice. It's all you see is, millions of acres of ice, and there you see carved in the ice in big letters is, "I am the Antarctica," which he had carved with his ski pole.
We're talking to David Grant about his new book, The White Darkness. It's a very beautiful book as well. I just would say there are beautiful photographs in here, just some stunning photography that really brings you to the location so you get a sense of what the environment was like. I mean, just from a picture, it's hard to imagine. What do you think we can learn from his life?
Yeah, I think it's, Henry was a remarkable figure in many ways. But I think what we learn about is a central question about leadership, even if we're not polar explorers. And it is also a central question about, is leadership always conquering and always succeeding? Or is it accepting failure and accepting your limitations? We often think of Shackleton too simply and reductively as someone always succeeded, as opposed to somebody who had failed. And I think that's the central question that Worsley reckoned with in his life. And I think that is something that we all have our own Antarcticas that we reckon with in our lives.
It's a fabulous read with gorgeous pictures. The name of it is The White Darkness. It is by David Grann from The New Yorker, staff writer at The New Yorker. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you so much.
That is it for All of It. Thank you so much for joining us. We hope to see you tomorrow at noon. All of It is produced by Megan Ryan, Rosie Guerin, Catherine Millsop, Andres O'Hara, Joseph Cabriglione, and Ursula Summer. Matt Miranda is our engineer, and Luscious Jackson does our theme music. You can follow us at Instagram at All of It WNYC. See you tomorrow.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.